Club him in the head with a hatchet? Smash, smash, smash!
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into...
Blizzard advisories for Boston. Even here, the eastern tip of Long Island, winter storm watches have been issued for New York City and up the Hudson River. So please be prepared. Winter storm Nemo is gearing up as we speak. And by this time tomorrow, we will begin to feel the impacts, even in the New York City area. Now notice later in the afternoon, that's when the snow will still be in earnest, if you will. And then it may mix in with a little bit of rain and snow later in the overnight hours. New York City. But then after that, believe it or not, as the low pressure moves away and those northwest winds take over, you'll be kind of on the backside of Nemo, and that's when the snow will really start to pick up to the tune of 6 to 12 inches in Manhattan, we're thinking. And not too far away, we're talking about 12 to 18 inches here, just north of the New York City area. Even heavier amounts as we head to Boston, and that is why we have the blizzard watch in effect, because not only are we talking about heavy snow, but those winds will be gusting at times up to 50 miles an hour, and that will create the blizzard conditions. So here's a look at the timeline for Boston. Notice as we progress through the evening hours tomorrow, the snow will really start to pick up, because these purples here, that's indicating heavy snow. And keep in mind, the winds will be a factor. So blowing snow, it'll be sideways, almost blinding snow in the Boston area, we're thinking, as we go through tomorrow evening, overnight tomorrow, and even lingering for the first half of Saturday. And as mentioned, to the tune of 12 to 18 inches in the Boston area, maybe up to 2 feet of snow in Boston. So we are here definitely keeping you updated on the latest from Winter Storm Nemo.
Hey, Mr. Grumpy Gills. When life gets you down, you know what you gotta do?
I don't wanna know what you gotta do.
Just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, swimming, swimming. What do? We swim, swim.
Dory, no singing.
Oh, 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 oh,
Dory.
I love to swim.
Dory.
When you want to swim, you want
See,
to
See, I'm gonna get stuck now with that song. Now it's in my head.
Sorry.
Hello, friends and family. Returning after a brief tangle with the Grim Reaper and the dark forest of disease that all of us will eventually have to hike into as long as our souls are imprisoned in the fleshy towers that we call our human bodies. Yes, it's true. The effects of radiation therapy sent me for a temporary day hike into the ancient forest of disease. And I'm not going to lie to you and tell you that this forest is a nice place. No, the forest of disease is not the sort of place you'd want to have a romantic picnic with your baby boo. And I'm not going to tell you that the animals that live in the forest of disease are the sort of animals that you might find in a petting zoo. Unless that petting zoo happened to be in the third circle of hell. Yes, the animals in the forest of disease are frightening beings, and I've seen a few of them firsthand. I've seen the greasy raccoon of nausea with his swirling yellow eyes that climbs into your anus and squirms its way through your intestinal tract and turns your stomach into a punching bag. So that everything you smell smells like the inner folds of a morbidly obese geriatric's underarm, and every moment is a fight against projectile vomiting wheat thins into your couch. And I've been attacked by the woodpecker of fatigue that comes flapping down from the hairy trees of the forest of despair and digs his claws into your back and pecks his way into your spine, injecting you with a cold poison of fatigue that makes you sleep for 12 hours a day in a coma-like nap. And I played chess with the cheating ape of logic, who shows you that it's easy to be positive when you're healthy, but an entirely different game altogether when a demonic fatigue woodpecker is injecting poison into your spine, or a nausea raccoon with swirling yellow eyes has climbed into your anus. And yes, I drank the wine of sadness with the techno moth, and that was fun. And I could go on and on about the forest of disease, and about the fat-ass, mewling, whiny goblin thing that invites you to go swimming in the lake of despair and give up, but I won't. Because the forest of disease is no more or no less than every other aspect of the phenomenal field that exists in this universe. It is a temporary and transient waveform. Something that will occasionally arise in the life of all human beings, but is guaranteed to dissipate. To quote the Bhagavad Gita, it is the body alone that gives rise to cold and heat, pleasure and pain. These experiences come and go and do not exist forever, and we must learn to bear them. Truly the wise man who is not disturbed by these things, indifferent alike to pain and pleasure, is fit for eternal life. In that forest of disease and despair, you see, I made the decision that I will no longer let my primitive ape-descendant instincts be confused by the laser pointer of experience that God has been teasing our species with since we climbed out of our moldering proto-hominid ape caves and devoured the psychedelic mushrooms that expanded our neocortex and turned us into humans. And as far as I'm concerned, this human existence is perfection. And that perfection includes the colon-climbing nausea raccoon and the spine-drilling fatigue woodpecker and even the creepy techno moth. And as long as I'm able, I will use my powers of perception to transform every aspect of phenomena that arises in my subjective universe into a vehicle that brings me closer to a state of unitive consciousness, or at least a colorful symbol that I can ramble about on this podcast. And I invite you to do the same. When you find yourself in your forest of despair and that raccoon comes knocking on the door of your asshole, I want you to turn to the raccoon and smile and say, "I love you, raccoon." And when that creepy demonic woodpecker with the sharp claws lands on your back and begins drilling into your spine, turn back and smile and say, "I know who you are, woodpecker. I know that you are just a force of love that's wearing the temporary and transient mask of turbulent phenomena. And peel back that mask and see underneath the truth. And the truth is that everything is love. And to quote Meher Baba, to penetrate into the essence of all being and significance and to release the fragrance of that inner attainment for the guidance and benefit of others by expressing in the world forms of truth, love, purity, and beauty, this is the sole game which has any intrinsic and absolute worth. Play the game, brothers and sisters. Love the anal raccoon, hug the drilling woodpecker, kiss the techno moth, and recognize that this entire material universe is simply a ghost story being told to you by a loving parent at an interdimensional slumber party.
Can we talk to you? Do you mind?
What do you want to talk about?
What happened today?
Well, went straight out of Dogtown, skateboarding, surfing it up. Before I say anything else, I want to say no matter what you've done, you deserve respect. Even if you make mistakes, you're lovable. And it doesn't matter your look, skills, or age, or size, or anything, you're worthwhile. No one could ever take that away from you. Now, this stuff right here, I was driving and I was in the passenger side of this car, and he comes over on there. He was over by the recycling center. He says, "Oh, when I was in the Virgin Islands, 30 years old on a business trip, I f***ed this 14-year-old. I was like, "You what?" He's like, "I raped this 14-year-old." Starts crying, gives me a big hug. He's like, "F***ing 300-pound guy." I'm like, "Oh, shit. He must be f***ing, man. Like, what's he talking about?" I didn't take him seriously at first. Comes driving down this way. He's like, "You know what? I come to realize I'm Jesus Christ, and I can do anything I f***ing want to. And watch this." Bam! And he smashed into this f***ing guy right there, pinned him in between that f***ing truck. And so I hop out, I look over, the guy's pinned there. I mean, like, freight train riders know this. Like, if you get pinned between something, do not move that, otherwise you bleed out. Like, motherfucker, I ran in, I grabbed the keys, he's sitting there like nothing even happened. And like, man, if you started driving that car around again, man, there would have been a hell of a lot of bodies around here. I hop on out, and so I grab the bag, I threw it over by that pole right there, and then buddy gets out, and these two women are trying to help him. He runs up and he grabs one of them, man. Like, a guy that big can snap a woman's neck like a pencil stick. So I ran up behind him with a hatchet, smash, smash, smash. Yeah.
The lady said you saved her life.
She was the one who got grabbed by that f***. You know what? F*** is cool. That guy ain't. F***.
How'd you get in his car? How did you?
I was hitchhiking. Good thing I was hitchhiking. Yeah, people say don't hitchhike. Well, this is what happens. At least I was here.
So he did this on purpose.
Dude, that guy was f***. Cooked out, man. Like, he's beyond howling. Like, I don't even see any breath in him. You know what I'm saying?
Can I get your name and where you're from, if you don't mind?
I'm Kai.
Kai? Can I get spelling for you,
straight
buddy?
Out of Dogtown. K-A-I.
K-A-I. Do you have a last name?
No, bro. I don't have anything.
Where are you from originally? Are you from Fresno area?
Sophia, West Virginia.
No kidding. How old are you?
I can't call it.
Okay. What? Have you ever experienced anything like today? And what made you take the actions that you did?
That woman was in danger. He just finished what looked like at the time killing somebody, and if I hadn't done that, he would have killed more people. So he's dead. Good.
You ever experienced anything like that, Kai?
Well, this one time I was in an orchard and this f***ing guy starts beating on this woman who he calls his. So I walked on over and I started smashing him in the head. You see all these teeth marks right here for the camera? Yeah, I started smashing him in the head and in the teeth, busted out all his teeth. Motherfucker, and the sheriffs, not the policy enforcers, show up and start like, they're like, yeah, so what happened? I mean, like, just give me any old name and just give me old birthday, whatever, just, yeah.
What happened today after the, you're obviously free now, but were you arrested? What was the process? What did they do to you when they came out? Obviously, they found out that you did the right thing, but the time that from the accident until now, where have you been?
Well, he started following I. Like, I cleaved his motherfucking head wide open with a hatchet. He stood up like he was pulled right up, right? And like, I'm like, bro, if you're Jesus Christ, I'll be the Antichrist, man. Like, that shit. And he starts following me off this way, so I figure I'll lure him away from the crowd. So I'm running off this way. I got a hatchet in one hand, motherfucking this bag I'm carrying over with another hand. I start running off that way. And so a couple of the people who was bystanders to it came over and told me to stop. And I was like, why stop? And he was like, the cop's already on their way. I was like, is he back up and doing anything? And somebody said that he was like masturbating in front of this school or whatever this place is right here. Yeah.
Were you questioned by police? Were you taken into custody? What happened? I mean, obviously.
I was put into the back of the sheriff's wagon. It wasn't the policies that pulled I over, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, so like, I got put in the back of the sheriff's wagon. The sheriff was like, what happened here? Took down a statement. I told him everything I just told you. And let me on out. Said I couldn't grab all this stuff until I had finished, like, they had finished with something, you know what I mean? And like, brought me back on over here so I could be in front of this thing, like this car right here. It is gnarly, man. Holy shit. It's like the biggest wave I've ever ridden in my life.
What's next for you, Kai?
Hopefully some surfing. If anybody's watching this somewhere else and they got a mini mile that they could lend a guy with a wetsuit, I'd love to test out Mavericks.
Would you do it again?
Club him in the head with a hatchet? You know, if I could go back in time, I'd go back over to where I was at that recycling center and he said that he had raped that chick over in the Virgin Islands, because it doesn't matter where you at. You can just spend a bunch of money and do whatever the fuck you want, you know, that's not right. If I could go back in time, I would have dabbed him up right there.
No, you're not, I mean, it doesn't seem like you have any concern for yourself. You're all about, I mean, doing the right thing and not even worrying about Kai first.
I don't have any family. Like, as far as anybody I grew up with is concerned, I'm already dead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Since I was a high school student, I've watched the escalation of the war on drugs, especially marijuana. I slowly became aware of its widespread use. As a freshman legislator in Oregon 40 years ago, my opinion was set by a hog farmer from eastern Oregon who was a state representative named Stafford Hansel. Stafford held the Oregon House, and the people crowded into the gallery spellbound with his tutorial on marijuana and its comparison to other addictive substances, both legal and illegal. This older gentleman, who didn't smoke, didn't drink alcohol, let alone use marijuana, made his case. He pointed out how tobacco was highly addictive and killed hundreds of thousands of Americans per year. He discussed alcohol, whose damaging properties had once led the country into a foolish, costly, and ultimately self-defeating experiment with prohibition. Alcohol use was damaging for some, led to dependency for many, while contributing to tens of thousands of highway deaths every year and serious health problems for countless others. By the time Representative Hansel got to marijuana, he'd convinced me that the bill he was advocating, two-plant legalization, was not just worthy of my support, which I was already inclined to do, but something that I should advocate, that Oregonians should be allowed this choice, less damaging and addicting than tobacco. We didn't legalize marijuana in 1973, although I was assured that if the 22 of us who had voted for the bill had been supported by the people who used it but voted no, the measure would have passed easily. We did make Oregon the first state to decriminalize the use of marijuana. Possession of a small amount was made a minor infraction, treated like a traffic ticket. Today, 40 years later, the case is even more compelling. 14 states have now decriminalized policies like Oregon passed in 1973. In 1996, California pioneered the legal use of medical marijuana, whose therapeutic qualities have long been known and employed. And since then, 18 states and the District of Columbia have approved medical marijuana initiatives, allowing its use to relieve chronic pain, nausea, and other conditions. Notably, two-thirds of these approvals were a result of voter initiatives. Last fall, voters in Colorado and Washington approved adult recreational use with 55% approval margins. Studies show that a majority of Americans now agree that marijuana should be legalized. It is time that the federal government revisit its policies. Drugs with less serious classifications like methamphetamine and cocaine have more serious law enforcement, health, and behavioral impacts, yet marijuana retains its Schedule I classification. In 2011, 250,000 people were arrested for using a substance that millions use, many more have tried, and a majority of Americans feel should be legal. Because there are stark racial differences in enforcement and incarceration, there are wide disparities in the legal treatment for communities of color versus their white counterpart. Medical marijuana is widely accepted but subject to inherent conflict with federal law that is unfair, confusing, and costly. A bipartisan group of legislators is developing a comprehensive package of legislation to clarify and reform outdated, ineffective, and unwise federal policies. In a time of great fiscal stress and a sea change in opinion of voters, this is a unique opportunity to save money on enforcement and incarceration, avoid unnecessary conflict and harsh treatment of users, provide a framework for medical marijuana, and even reduce the deficit, all by honoring the wish of two-thirds of Americans to respect states' rights for marijuana, just like we do for alcohol. I would invite my colleagues to join this effort in developing a marijuana policy that makes sense for America today.
With just 10 months left before state-run pot stores are scheduled to open, lawmakers in Olympia are trying to hammer out the logistics of legal marijuana. Today, they heard testimony from citizens and community leaders.
Our overriding concern is what happens to our youth. We already know the predictable but unintended consequence of privatizing liquor was increased use by youth.
If I would have been treated with medical marijuana in my early 20s, I would not have been nearly as sick as I was the rest of my life.
Legislators are working on two bills that would help clarify how officials and law enforcement deal with recreational marijuana. They're considering how much pot growers or sellers can legally carry, what exactly will be taxed, and how the new law affects medical marijuana.
Now that it's illegal to smoke marijuana for medical and recreational purposes in this state, how will the state determine if someone is driving under the influence of too much pot? That's the question facing the State House Public Safety Committee. Tomorrow, it will try to figure out what's legal under the voter-approved Initiative 502 and how pot affects a person's driving ability.
Light it up, smoke it up. I wanna stimulate my mind.
So I took it up.
Can I get a hit?
Can I get a whoo?
Give me that fat bag of weed in the fruit. So I can get faded, elevated. Smoke the joint down to a road and I ate it. I stand true to the guest guy.
As I keep running from the truth, I
give me that.
State lawmakers are also tackling the new marijuana law, including how it affects DUI cases. At a hearing today, experts weighed in on the law's impacts, including how it can still be illegal for one person to give another marijuana despite the drug being legal.
Hi. Sort of in this awkward interim period where it's sort of you can have it, but you can't get it. It's like the marijuana fairy gives it to you.
Looks like New Orleans police are picking up the pieces after spending most of the night struggling to contain a rioting Ray Lewis following the Ravens' exciting Super Bowl victory. Just moments after Baltimore clinched the 34-31 win, a jubilant Lewis spilled out onto the streets, rampaging through the French Quarter until early this morning, setting fires, overturning police cars, and trampling up to 25 people in a burst of raucous joy. New Orleans Police Chief Ronald Surpass told reporters, quote, "We were prepared for the possibility that a Ravens victory might cause Ray Lewis to get out of hand. Unfortunately, tear gas seemed to have no effect. He was already crying." By 2:30 a.m., police were reporting that Ray Lewis had scattered, and city crews were cleaning up $12 million worth of damage. Next up, maternity wards are already bracing for the wave of Super Bowl blackout babies anticipated in 9 months.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Islands. From the Redwood Forest. Hallelujah. To to the Gulfstream waters. This land was made for you and me. God, we thank you for the land. We thank you for the land. Hallelujah. And because we have the land, we thank you for the farms. And the song says, Old MacDonald had a farm. Hallelujah. E-I-E-I-O. And on his farm, he had some pigs. E-I-E-I-O. Oh, with an onk onk here and an onk onk there. Onk here, onk we're onk. Everywhere, onk onk. Old MacDonald had a farm. E-I-E-I-O. And God, because we have pigs, there's chillings today on our tables, God. You're so mindful of your people. And we have chillings today, God. Hallelujah. And Louisiana hot sauce. You're mindful, God. You're mindful, God.
You Catholic. I'm Holy Ghost Funky Gut Bucket Baptist.
Gruesome find at Chicago's O'Hare Airport, 18 human heads. The medical examiner's office says the severed heads, which were wrapped in plastic, arrived from Italy. They say the heads were bound for a research facility, that it was a mix-up in paperwork and delaying the shipment's final delivery. Police are ruling out foul play.
Club him in the head with a hatchet?
An Italian museum crammed full of skulls, brains, and skeletons of 19th century criminals is facing a legal battle from descendants to return their body parts. One exhibit at the Cesar Lombroso Museum of Criminal Anthropology in Turin, which is the life's work of Cesar Lombroso, a now deceased Italian physician and psychiatrist, could be under threat. The museum showcases an extensive collection of criminal research, physical work, and documents looking into the psychology of crime, and it plays an important role in Italian science's history, according to the museum's director, Silvano Montaldo. However, this could be about to change. The descendants of highway robber Giuseppe Viella, whose skull features in the collection, are now fighting for their ancestors' remains to be returned. Viella's descendants claim that he was not a criminal and therefore should not be included in the museum. They say he was a committed father to five children and his only crime was to steal a lamb to feed his hungry family. The local government of Italian town Motta Santa Luisa have supported the descendants and are now backing the release of the item. But official records say otherwise and state the man in question lived a long and varied life of crime before dying in 1872.
The king of the car park. What has been speculated about for so long has now finally been confirmed.
It is the academic conclusion of the University of Leicester that beyond reasonable doubt, the individual exhumed at Greyfriars in September 2012 is indeed Richard III, the last Plantagenet King of England.
So these human bones found in a public car park in the Midlands are definitely those of England's Richard III. The skeleton showed signs of injuries consistent with the wounds he received at the 1485 Battle of Bosworth. Also, the DNA taken from Michael Ibsen, a Canadian-born carpenter, believed to be a direct descendant of Richard's sister Anne of York, helped solve the riddle.
It was startling, shocking in so many ways. And I remember at one point, after they'd excavated the remains, standing before this hole in the ground in this car park and thinking, here, we think, has lain Richard III for 500 years. And there's a link between myself and this man. Extraordinary, really.
So what will happen to Richard III's remains now? Well, some would like them to stay in Leicester, while others would like to see a state funeral for the king in London. Benedict is to resign on February the 28th. The decision by the 85-year-old, who has a reputation as a charming and shy man, apparently took even his closest aides by surprise. The Pope feels he doesn't have the strength to continue in office due to his advanced age. As the powerful Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, he had the nickname of God's Rottweiler due to his pursuit of those who strayed from Orthodox teaching. The Pope's image, though, did soften in office, but he proved himself to be strongly against homosexuality, abortion, and the use of artificial birth control. The Vatican hopes to have a new Pope in place by the end of March. The last Pope to resign was Gregory XII, who stepped down in 1415.
Volts of electricity. Burst into flame.
Picture at the heart of a new and growing controversy in American schools. This is a padded room, a photo spreading from Washington State to parents around the country. They are called isolation rooms, and they're used to restrain some children, including autistic ones. ABC's chief investigative correspondent Brian Ross brings us videotape, and we warn you, it's not always easy to watch.
This surveillance video shows high school student Andre McCollins in the lower right of the screen, about to go through what his school calls skin shock therapy for misbehavior. About 60 volts of therapy. There are no national standards for the punishments or restraints used on school children, including those like Andre with behavior disabilities, later tied spread eagle to a restraint board.
No.
And what happened at this school outside Boston, an extreme example, was entirely legal.
Someday we're all going to look back and we're going to say, can you believe what we did here?
An ABC News investigation has found that only 17 states have specific laws protecting students from harsh treatments and restraints.
There's thousands and thousands of children that have been traumatized, that have been injured.
In Arizona and Washington State, parents are up in arms over padded isolation boxes or cells where students have been left for long stretches. In Kentucky, a mother found her autistic 8-year-old son had been stuffed into a duffel bag like this one, specially made to restrain children.
They held me like...
In Pennsylvania, a group of students with behavioral issues described to ABC News how they had been tied up or manhandled at previous schools.
Did it hurt?
Yeah, it really did hurt.
11-year-old Jordan described being locked up in one of those isolation boxes.
It's scary. Really scary. Even for the bravest person in the world, it's still really scary.
Bionic Man can literally walk the walk and talk the talk.
Hello, everyone. I feel exposed.
Rex, as he has been called, is made with the latest advances in prosthetic technology, including artificial organs, synthetic blood, and robotic limbs.
I am a $1 million man.
The £640,000 project has gone on display at London's Science Museum and will feature in the Channel 4 documentary How to Build a Bionic Man. Swiss social psychologist and researcher Bertolt Meyer, who himself uses a bionic hand, says it was a fascinating project.
I was very lucky to be a part of it, kind of just overseeing the build, which was a team effort, really, by a team of roboticists and, of course, all the great scientists who work on these different body parts. And this is basically to showcase what bionic technology can do already, but also what it can't do already. And awkward because, well, I think the face is a bit off. I actually find it quite awkward to look at. So a very, very interesting journey this has been.
As well as robotic limbs, the bionic man also has an artificial pancreas, kidney, spleen, trachea, and functional blood circulation system.
Some humans ain't human. Some people ain't kind. You open up their hearts, and here's what you'll find. A few frozen pizzas, some ice cubes with hair, a broken popsicle. You don't wanna go there. Some humans ain't human, though they walk like we do. They live and they breathe just to turn the old screw. They screw you when you're sleeping. They try to screw you blind. Some humans ain't human. Some people ain't kind.
Well, for the past 5 hours, they've had this entire block completely closed off to the public. Both local and federal police are still here. Jim, I want you to pan over to this direction to sort of show you the perimeter here. You can see the Department of Homeland Security also still here. What we know is that at about 7:15 this morning, a security guard confronted what's being called a suspicious person in the parking lot here to the right. Just about another tick or two here to the right, Jim, from where we're looking now. You can still see a hat and what appears to be a side mirror in that parking lot, and there are tread marks in the grass out front here. Police tell us at that point when the security guard confronted this person, shots were fired, and at some point a 15-year-old boy was injured. He was in a vehicle that then left the scene. In fact, it gets a little more dramatic. A few blocks away, that vehicle was involved in a hit-and-run accident, and it was a short time after that where the 15-year-old boy was found at his house injured. Police are not calling it gunshot wounds. We don't know if he was injured in that hit-and-run or if he was shot, but he is being treated right now at Evergreen Hospital. The security guard was complaining about some sort of leg injury. He's being treated right now as well. The big overriding question in all of this, Greg, is what led up to the shooting? What prompted the security guard to pull his weapon and fire at a 15-year-old boy?
You might go to church and sit down in a pew. Those humans who ain't human are sitting right next to you. They talk about your family. They talk about your clothes when they don't know their own. Thank you. from their own elbows. Jealousy and stupidity don't equal harmony. Jealousy and stupidity don't equal harmony.
It was kind of scary because what if, like, he tried to kill somebody? And it turns out he actually did. He had a list that of people who he wanted to kill.
This is a different case. Two fifth-grade boys at Fort Colville Elementary School arrested for plotting to kill an ex-girlfriend and hurt at least seven other students. Another student saw a knife in one of the boys' backpacks and told teachers. School officials later found a gun and ammunition as well. Those boys were arrested and expelled. Investigators say the gun was stolen and the two had been apparently planning this attack for at least 2 weeks.
People are going to be criticizing, complaining about the CIA. I have all of you to say, you knew about what the CIA was doing, you supported it, and you will defend it.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Senator Burke.
Thank you, Chairman. And I'm going to try to be brief because I've noticed you're in your fourth glass of water, and I don't want to be accused of waterboarding you.
That's a good one.
Did you ever notice when you're feeling really good, there's always a pigeon a coming on your hood? Or you're feeling your freedom and the world's off your back, when that hot shot from Texas starts his own war in Iraq. Some humans ain't human. Some people ain't kind. They lie through their teeth with their head up there behind. You open up their heart, here's what you'll find. Some humans ain't human. Some people ain't kind.
Subject line reads, last resort. It's perhaps the only explanation we'll ever hear from the alleged shooter, Christopher Dorner. Over 11,000 words posted on his Facebook page earlier today, addressed simply to America. It's pages and pages of threats, confessions, and rambling opinions, and it is chilling to read. He writes, quote, I know I'll be vilified by the LAPD and the media. Unfortunately, this is a necessary evil that I do not enjoy, but must partake and complete for substantial change to occur within the LAPD and reclaim my name. The question is, what would you do to clear your name? Dorner clearly wants vindication from the LAPD, which terminated him in 2008 for making false statements to a superior officer. The attacks will stop when the department states the truth about my innocence publicly, he writes. I will not accept any type of currency, goods, in exchange for the attacks to stop, nor do I want it. I want my name back, period. There is no negotiation. The alleged shooter details evidence he says shows he was telling the truth, and he urges the media to investigate his case. He writes, quote, with the discovery and evidence available, you will see the truth. Unfortunately, I will not be alive to see my name cleared. Dorner writes repeatedly about his own death. At one point, he writes, self-preservation is no longer important to me. I do not fear death. He also writes, I have nothing to lose. You cannot prevail against an enemy combatant who has no fear of death. Dorner wants to make sure he's not branded a liar, but seems to have no concerns about being a killer. He promises the violence of action will be high. And he lists members of the LAPD by name in his manifesto, writing, in essence, I've lost everything because the LAPD took my name and knew I was innocent. Your day has come. Later, he writes, you destroyed my life and name because of your actions. Time is up. Dorner doesn't stop there. He writes, suppressing the truth will lead to deadly consequences for you and your family. I never had the opportunity to have a family of my own. I'm terminating yours. It seems he made good on that promise. Police say on Sunday he shot and killed 27-year-old Monica Kwan, the daughter of one of the officers named in the manifesto. Two others have also been shot so far, and the manifesto threatens that more will come. I know your route to and from home and your division, he writes. I know your significant other's routine, your children's best friends, and recess. I assure you that the casualty rate will be high. Dorner doesn't just stick to threats. The manifesto is also filled with bizarre ramblings and everything from newscasters to gun control to entertainment. He says he's a fan of the Hangover movies and even offers this opinion about Michelle Obama. Off the record, I love your new bangs, Mrs. Obama, he writes. A woman whose professional and educational accomplishments are second to none when compared to recent first wives. Throughout this manifesto posted on his Facebook page, Dorner's tone is unwavering. He's on a crusade, he feels, to purge the LAPD of corruption, and he tries to portray himself as a person of morals. He writes, I'm not an aspiring rapper, I'm not a gang member, I'm not a dope dealer. I'm a man who's lost complete faith in the system when the system betrayed, slandered, and libeled me. I lived a good life, and though not a religious man, I always stuck to my own personal code of ethics. No one grows up and wants to be a cop killer, he writes. It was against everything I've ever was. As a young police explorer, I found my calling in life. But as a young police officer, I found that the violent suspects on the street are not the only people you have to watch.
This next record is dedicated to some personal friends of mine, the LAPD. For every cop that has ever taken advantage of somebody, beat them down or hurt them because they got long hair, listened to the wrong kind of music, wrong color, whatever they thought was the reason to do it. For every one of those police, I'd like to take a pig out here in this parking lot and shoot them in their motherfucking face.
Thanks for staying with us tonight. This story sounds like it's right out of the movies, but it's dangerously real tonight. Hundreds of police officers are braving snowy conditions in the California mountains to find Christopher Dorner. Dorner is a 33-year-old ex-police officer and war veteran wanted for killing three people and wounding two others over the past few days. Officers say Dorner has declared war on the police force, and they're worried he won't stop killing until he's dead.
Police fear that a fired cop and alleged killer
could be anywhere right now plotting his next move, stalking his next victim. We've gotten a hold of some exclusive images of Christopher Jordan Dorner firing a gun back in 2005 at a firing range for Los Angeles police officers in training. Right now, Dorner is the target of a round-the-clock manhunt, but there's been no trace of him since yesterday.
Cop killer just started posting to Facebook recently, if you can even imagine, and there are dozens of pictures and postings. Tom Foreman is here and has been taking a closer look into all this. Tom, what are you finding?
Kate, we don't know for sure, as it often is the case with Facebook, that this is necessarily his page. What we do know is that a page was started on the 21st of January, very recently, under his name, and the very next day, more than 200 photographs were dumped into it. Many of them look like exactly what he mentions in this manifesto, this idea of a smiling, happy person that you would see enjoying his work.
Weapon mentioned in the manifesto is this thing. It's a little scary too. The SA-7 Manpad, a Russian-made shoulder-mounted surface-to-air missile launcher. It is illegal in the United States. In fact, the State Department says on its website, anyone with knowledge of an illicit Manpad should immediately contact the FBI. So some pretty scary weapons there, quite frankly. If that's what he says he has, Wolf, all we know, he says in his manifesto that he has these.
Tonight we get even.
Flashes of a deputy's gun as he runs after a suspect. This dramatic video, the basis of a lawsuit against the LA County Sheriff's Department. Surveillance cameras at the corner of Long Beach Boulevard and Josephine Avenue in Lynnwood captured the fatal shooting nearly 2 years ago. The video shows a squad car pulls up next to three men walking along the street. The deputy flashes a light at them. As he exits the car, 20-year-old Jonathan Cuevas starts running, and the deputy opens fire. We've frozen the video before it shows one final shot.
He fires six shots running towards Jonathan, and the seventh shot, he stands over Jonathan and shoots him right through the torso as a coup de grace kill shot.
The deadly encounter happened on the night of October 20th, 2010. According to the coroner's report, three of the bullets struck Cuevas in the back and the fourth went through his right side. The sheriff's department says the deputy opened fire after Cuevas pointed a gun at him. The department defends the deputy's actions, saying the shooting has been thoroughly investigated.
Was he armed? Yes. Is the whole story being told now? No. Let's not forget who has already investigated this. Internal Affairs. Office of Independent Review monitoring that. Homicide Bureau. The District Attorney.
The Cuevas family has now filed a $5 million wrongful death lawsuit against the department and says the video shows the 20-year-old posed no threat to the deputy. Family's attorney calls the circumstances surrounding that alleged weapon suspicious.
The weapon that he says Jonathan had is nowhere to be found, but he says it's a silver-plated weapon. The photo of the weapon that they send us is a wood-handled revolver, black weapon.
Now, the attorney says the fingerprints, that there were no fingerprints of Cuevas's on that gun, and he questions its authenticity.
Right now, more than ever, the American people, and activists in particular, need to commit to the non-aggression principle and make this commitment absolutely clear by speaking out about it. The non-aggression principle is very simple. Do not initiate violence. Do not fire the first shot. Do not attack unless you are attacked. This doesn't mean that you can't defend yourself, but what it does mean is that you have to do everything in your power to prevent a situation from escalating to violence. Whoever strikes first will lose the hearts and the minds of the people, and that's the most important asset in any conflict. If you want to be proactive, if you want to change the course that we're on, then start by calling your local sheriffs. Start by reaching out to everyone you know in police and military. Ask them point blank if they're prepared to refuse to comply with orders that violate the Constitution. Talk to them about the Oath Keepers. Let them know that they're not alone, and that you will support them when it's time for them to refuse those unlawful orders. This is how we win, by mass non-compliance, by making the federal government's orders irrelevant, not by initiating violence.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
I am always there. So when you get tired of listening to fake players, I am there for your CD player. Play a track, bring it back to something relevant, because real men move with intelligence, and the down presser don't tell me what to say, and I figure if a man is scared to die, he's already dead anyway. So imagine me supporting some villain who gets funded millions to jump in my system and start peeling caps at my children. Soon as I turn a beat on, he trying to beat on my woman. Every line is rhyme designed to prevent my son from becoming a man. He want him to die by 25, see his father bop into the beat, shed a tear. Wonder why I would support some disgrace since he got jewels glued to his face when putting material possessions over the love of our community is how we became slaves in the first place. But I am always there, always shining. Ain't no diamonds necessary. When I'm gone, I want he was a man to be the only sentence printed on my obituary. Incendiary against cats who don't make sense because I figure they're against my community. Do what his master says in order to get paid in cars and jewelry. Then can't come out on the block unless he got at least 50 cops. And if I can't leave my home, what the fuck do I need with a platinum watch? But watch me. I'm always there. Round the clock, phone call away. If your name come out somebody's mouth, they better be careful what they about to say, cause that's me, eyes glaring, nose flaring, staring, daring somebody to come test by your side. Do a dime, ain't no require bulletproof vest. Treat your children like my own. Something happened to you, I got them till they grown. No matter where you walking by yourself, believe me, God, you ain't never alone, cause I am always there. I represent you from the boardroom to the street. I only care about two things, that's my principles and making sure our family eat. And don't you worry about his numbers, cause I both he got like two or three summers, and after that it's back to flat and crack like he's some old broke-ass plumber. But believe, I got you from below 0 to 130 degrees. My love don't cease. Your enemies are my enemies. And you ain't never had a friend like me. I am always there.
Now, go find the others. .com
Wait, ding, ding, ding. Uh-oh, looks like we're out of time. Goodbye.